You are listening to Arts on the Air, a bi-weekly-ish interview show dedicated to Savannah, Georgia's artists, musicians, and authors. Each episode will feature a guest in conversation about their philosophy, practice, and current projects, as well as their thoughts on the state of the arts in our community of Savannah. Our theme music is a clip of Summer Nights by the Eric Jones Trio. It's provided by our friend Mark Chesnow, who plays with the Eric Jones Trio every Thursday and Sunday at Good Times Jazz Bar downtown. Hey everyone, welcome to Arts on the Air. This is Tamara Garvey, and I have the pleasure of sitting down today with Danelle Lejeune. Welcome.
Hi.
So happy to have you. On your website, it's pretty cool. You have your kind of three categories: your fine art photographer, poet and memoirist, and then book coach and editor. And I'm going to read just a little line of your about page. Danelle was a livestock farmer in southern Iowa. She moved to Georgia with her three kids and nothing else in 2016 to begin again from the ground up. After a 20-year hiatus, she's writing poetry, making art, and creating a lot of chaos with her opinions on onions and pies. It's great. It gives a really interesting overview of, and you kind of had me from the first sentence as a livestock farmer. That's fascinating. Did you grow up on a farm? Is that how that happened?
Sort of, and yes and no. I spent weekends with my aunts in Colorado. We lived in Greeley. She lived like directly south near the Kansas border in the most like dead, ugliest place of Colorado. You could see the mountains in the distance and you could smell the stockyards. But she raised buffalo and cows, and wow. She also had a lot of empty, vacant land that the government paid her not to farm, which she said was fine because it was completely unfarmable. And she was a volunteer firefighter as well, who owned her own fire truck. And I would spend weekends and summers at her house helping her as much as a child can with a lot of stuff, riding along. So I knew it was possible for, she didn't grow up that way either. She moved out there in her 30s and just decided to do it. And so I did something similar. When my children were little, I just decided to move from where we were living. Didn't feel safe anymore. We lived in a city and there was a drive-by shooting and a murder on our front steps. So done living in the city. And my aunt had done it, so why couldn't I? But I had just planned on homesteading, buying a house similar to the house, you know, it's not any different than moving across town, except more acres and a bigger lawnmower. And we started with 20 chickens that we got from the feed store, converted an old little grain silo into a chicken run. And then I thought, well, maybe we could raise a pig, kind of like Charlotte's Web. We could raise a pig, except eat them at the end, right? And we went to get pigs. And the farmer was like, well, they're social creatures, so you need to buy two. But since you're beginning, one might die, so you need to buy three. And I only have four, so you have to buy all of them.
Why would one die? Are they that hard to take care of? There's that much of a learning curve?
No, it was just the line to get me to buy all of his pigs.
He just needed to move all his pigs. Okay.
Yeah.
So you had four pigs?
Four pigs, and they were easy. I barbed wired off an old, it was a 100-foot by 100-foot pen that had been where a barn had burned down. And so it was already there. And right, I got a little hoop shelter and I raised them and people helped me. And so at the end, I sold two of the pigs for meat, which paid for the entire operation. I fed them fallen pears and apples from a local orchard. I fed them our kitchen scraps and the pig slop. And it was really, it felt fun and easy. My kids were little, they helped. But people raved about the pork so much that I got calls, people saying, I will pay you to buy another pig and raise it for me if you can make those pork chops taste that way.
Wow.
So the next year we did 15 pigs. Had to get a little bit bigger space. Obviously, that's not enough space for 15. Yeah. And sold out, made a profit.
And are you, so as a pig and chicken farmer, are you working from morning till night working on these?
And I had little kids like under the age of four and got pregnant with a third in the middle of that.
Wow.
And so we started fencing off. We had 40 acres and there was 10 acres that could be fenced off into pasture. And we were like starting to fence it off. And I wanted to get a dairy cow because I was dumb like that.
Why not make it even harder? Yeah.
Right. Why not? My Amish neighbor had one, why not? And so we got some dairy cows, and then a lady who was moving to Canada couldn't take her sheep with her, said, "Will you take my sheep?"
My
And
gosh.
suddenly we had a llama and a herd of sheep and three cows. And
Most people who have farms don't have a huge variety of animals, right? Don't people usually just have one type and they stick with it? Okay.
But I was modeling after small homestead. Right. I was thinking
Yeah.
we have a dairy cow and we have this and we have this. And we also had a 10-acre pond with aquaculture so we could fish and started tapping trees. We were producing so much of our own food and people were going wild over it.
You had like you were like an early Americana settler. Just doing
Felt
it
like
all.
it. And it's in the middle of Iowa, it's very brutal in the winter.
Yeah.
And
This is
with
it's interesting also when you mentioned you had Amish near you. I'm only familiar with Amish people kind of living in Pennsylvania. I didn't know that Iowa was an area.
Yeah, it's a huge Amish place. Maytag started in as an Amish thing, the washing machine.
Oh, really?
And so like all of Eastern Iowa is very Amish, but I was in Southern Iowa, so they were and Northern Missouri. There's a big community there.
Okay. So could you meet with like the Amish people who had already been farming? Were they the ones kind of helping you with things? Like were
No, it was other millennial Gen Xer crazy people podcasters
Oh
that we
my
were
gosh.
learning from. You know what I'm talking about? And it was a permaculture movement, which is wonderful, but a lot of it got kind of extreme. Little break off cults following personalities, very not woman friendly.
Wow.
Very male dominated, big personality dominated. But the science was so intriguing to me. And I went to Iowa State for my graduate program and I studied material technologies for historic preservation. I know it's like a classic ADHD-er story, like so many interests.
That is delightfully specific as a major.
Yes. Well, I was restoring the house in the city. I was restoring it and I wanted to learn more about how to restore it well.
Oh.
In Iowa, a degree in historic preservation would be better served if you just got a bulldozer operation license. They don't care.
They're not concerned with preservation.
No, there are a couple buildings I helped do surveys on and engineering analysis. And the next day, the paper would say, engineers found it unstable and a public hazard. And like, we haven't even written our report yet. We didn't
Wow.
say that. It was a solid building. And then it would be torn down by the end of the week. And
Well, that answers my later question to come about what brought you to Savannah. So that's interesting.
crazy enough, it wasn't that that brought me to Savannah.
Oh.
Ossabaw pigs. I ended up raising Ossabaw pigs and I wanted to learn more about Ossabaw pigs, and so did my family. We switched from raising, eventually, we were raising 60 pigs in 10 batch cycles throughout the year. It was great.
Yeah.
It was sustainable. It was able to produce a living. And I still had my job at teaching online classes, and my ex-husband still had his job. Not an ex at the time, working in an insurance company, but we were starting to feel like we could build the farm to something bigger and better. And maybe he could quit his job and be full-time home, which would be helpful with three small children and all of the work I was doing. So they got this great idea to send me to Ossabaw Island, pretend to be a writer, and learn more about the pigs in their natural habitat. My husband, now ex, and his father. They found, like, because they were looking up so much about Ossabaw pigs, their Facebook algorithm started putting in their ads the Ossabaw writers retreats. And they
Okay.
hatched an idea over Thanksgiving dinner that one of us should go there to study the pigs, but who could pretend to be a writer? And they were like, well, you have a mommy blog. That's kind of like writing.
So you applied with that and you did get in.
I applied with a portfolio of poetry from my high school years
Okay.
because I didn't really have my blog entries. I didn't feel like were very worthy. I don't know why I thought that, but looking back, I am kind of embarrassed. It was very, like, I didn't copy edit very well. It's full of errors. So I just submitted a thing of poetry and I got in. And it, you get in and you have to pay the full tuition. So I just did that. I mean, we'd already discussed it. I was going if I got in. But when my husband found out that I had gotten in over poetry, he was really mad. And I was like, well, what doesn't matter what I got in with? I'm just going to study the pigs anyway. It doesn't matter. And he was really upset and he shut off my credit cards so I couldn't buy plane tickets. My friends got very angry about this. They raised money for a bus ticket. So I rode the mega bus. And his parents watched my kids for the week because even though at that point he had quit his job and was at home, he didn't want to watch the kids and said he wouldn't do it and it would be child neglect for me to leave them with him. So,
And his entire issue was just that you had applied with your poetry and not with your quote unquote mommy blog.
yeah,
Okay.
which was very weird. Came up again and again later. But so I rode the mega bus, which is a whole like I could write a novel about what happened on the mega bus. It was crazy. I don't understand how those are legal at all. But I mean, I saw drug deals, I saw things going on. Mega bus, 72-hour bus ride. I made it to Atlanta where a friend from high school had moved, and she said she would take me from Atlanta to Savannah, which then I did, like 3 days of no sleeping, right? And we get there. And it had said there would be a ferry to the islands. I thought, like a ferry you drive your car onto. I'm terrified of boats. It was a little four-person fishing boat they wanted us to get on. And I'm like, nope, I'm done. Can I have a refund, please? And they're like, yeah, no. And Jennifer, my friend, pushed me onto the boat. And she said, it's more dangerous to get off the boat now. And the pilot just took off. And I'm like, ah, well, I guess I'm doing this now.
Yeah.
So here we go.
Exposure therapy.
Yeah. And you know, I was shaking, but that vision over the water was really significant. And so when I got to the island, I looked around. It was really primitive, and I didn't know what I was getting into. It was, talk about imposter syndrome. I was literally an imposter pretending to be a writer.
Yeah, you were undercover going to do recon
Right.
on pigs,
And
so.
people got so sick of me talking about bacon and how to cook it properly that eventually no one would go on the walks with me to look for pigs. And in the meantime, too, I'm also participating in all of the workshops, the craft stuff, like trying to keep up. Yeah, I'm a poet and
Yeah.
doing work.
And were you, I mean, I guess you were enjoying the writing aspect anyway, if you had done poetry in high school and then you were writing this blog
Yeah.
as an adult. So.
Yeah, I was really enjoying it. It was the first time I'd been away from my children, except to have more of them. And no one was asking me to wipe their butt.
Yeah.
And I was being talked to like I was a human being. I really didn't have a lot of adult interaction other than customers, and most of that was online. So it was
What year was this that you were doing this?
2014.
Okay.
And it was life-changing to be treated just normal. And one night that everybody went to bed and left the place a mess, and I couldn't handle it. I could not sleep knowing that there were dirty dishes out. And so I got up and I cleaned everything. And what I found out later is the director would come over to clean after everyone went to bed. And once the lights went out, he went over there and everything was sparkling. He said, like, magic fairy dust sparkling. And so he got to just go to bed instead of stay up late and do everybody's dishes. And the next night, the same. And he couldn't figure out because no one was talking about who did it. So that comes into play later. But this one afternoon, the last day on the island, I still hadn't seen a pig. I was really frustrated. So I took a knife from the kitchen to protect myself. We weren't supposed to go out alone. But no one would go with me. They were sick of hearing me talk about bacon. And I took off and I had my phone, but the GPS went out and I ended up lost. And I sat down on a log, kind of frustrated, and I heard this giant plop, splash. And it was a 14-foot American alligator. And my dad's Cajun, he's from Louisiana. I knew about alligators, I thought. So this panic, adrenaline, I'm like, oh, this is how my story ends. This is how I am going to die.
Yeah.
So I look at my phone, I take a picture because I figure if they find my phone, at least they'll know like what ate me. And oh, there's some signal. So I texted Jennifer and said, "Can you tell my children I love them? Here's the GPS coordinates where my bones are."
Not dramatic at
And
all.
I sent her the picture. And she texts back, "It's 40 degrees where you are. That alligator is just looking at you. So take your Yankee butt back to the clubhouse and get some unsweet tea because this is ridiculous. You're just being dramatic."
Well, you really texted the perfect person who had knowledge of alligator behavior.
She had gone to SCAD and was familiar with the area. And so I thought that, you know, yeah. So I was like, okay, it's 40 degrees and they're a reptile. So they really aren't going to come after me. That's cool. So I stood up and I took a bunch more pictures. Like, why not? Right. She had given me kind of like she sent me a hand-drawn picture of a map so that I could find my way back from where I was. She looked at the coordinates on kind of figured out where I was at and and said that to me. So I walked back, but adrenaline does something to you. So I was still shaking, very much shaking in the same way I shook after my C-sections, because of the adrenaline and near-death experience is how I put it. And I sat down on the couch and I was just trying to like get myself together so I wouldn't be embarrassed for dinner. And the poetry faculty, Neil Shepherd, and the director, Toni Morris, sat down next to me thinking I was having a nervous breakdown because that happens a lot. I didn't know that. Writers have nervous breakdowns during retreats. Didn't
Oh.
have any idea. And they, one brought me coffee, the other said, you know, you have a voice and we want to see you do something with this poetry. Not what you submitted in portfolio, but what you created in the workshops, you definitely have a distinctive voice that needs to be developed. And then Neil sent me a list of places to submit my poetry to. And my friend Jennifer sent me a text saying, those pictures you took are freaking amazing. You need to do something. I'm like, I just took them with my
Oh.
iPhone. And she said, no, send them to be published. And she sent me a list of places. And I don't normally promise people things because I'm so scatterbrained, I can't keep my promises. But I promised both sets of people that I would do something about it. So after dinner that night, I took my stuff and I submitted it to various places. By the time I got back to Iowa, I was getting acceptances for my work. And
Wow, that's
one of the
incredible.
photographs, one of the photographs was fought over by Portland Review and Flywing Journal. And they negotiated between themselves, without my knowledge, who got digital and who got print rights. Okay, this matters. 3 months later, and I'm just like writing poetry on the back of feed receipts while I'm waiting for grain to get dumped in my truck. And I'm doing it. I get a call from Iowa State, where Flyway Journal is, and they say they're going to April next year and they'd like to use my images for their posters.
I'm sorry, they're going to what? You cut out for a second.
AWP, which is, I actually don't know what it stands for, Associated Writing Program, I think. So
Okay.
it's like all of the journal, poetry journals, all the writing journals, all of the MFA programs from all over the country get together and have a big conference. It's basically people get drunk and talk about poetry for a whole weekend, take over a city and do that. It's cool. And I was like, sure, what do I get? And she was like, free tickets. I'm like, cool. About a month later, Tony from Asaba called me and said, you're the one, I found out you're the one who was cleaning. I can give you half off tuition if you come back and you just do that every night. And
Wow.
half off tuition. Now I tease him because I married him. I tease him like, why didn't you give me full tuition? Like half tuition, really? Okay.
He
So
married, that was so funny. That was like meme or something where it's like, reader, I married him.
yeah,
You both.
right. Much, much later. So I went back and I did more. And that retreat, I also helped with some of the social media, along with another intern he brought back who's named Tracy Foud, who just won the Donald Hall Prize 2 years ago. But she wasn't there for poetry. She was there for fiction, and we convinced her to become a poet. So it's sort of, we're all very proud of that. But that was a big retreat. 2015 was huge.
Yeah.
And right after I left, that was the AWP. So all these connections, when I got to Minneapolis, AWP was, I had told my, at the time, husband, I was like, I got this. My stuff's going to be there. I want us to take a weekend and go.
Yeah.
And he said, a weekend with a bunch of poets in Minneapolis. No, thank you. We're not going. And I heard, we're not going, but I didn't hear, I don't get to go.
Right.
But kids went to grandparents. So I went. And it was amazing. And I took, Iowa State made these postcards of my work. And I just walked around and introduced myself to people. And I have a lot of anxiety. So that was totally out of my, like having that to introduce myself to people helped. And
Yeah.
I got to meet the editor at Portland Review, who published my work, and a literary mama who published my first poems, and really just had a blast and ran into the Asaba folks, Neil and Tracy. And they invited me to an offsite reading and dinner afterwards. And at that meeting, I got very anxious, kind of stood in the back. The meeting was over, but or the reading was over, was with Salmon Press out of Ireland. And Neil was still talking with people. Tracy was still talking with people. And this guy walks up to me and said, Neil told me about you. I was like, cool. Who are you? He introduced himself and we started talking. I handed him the postcard, started telling him about Asaba pigs and my friend who lived in Prague. And he said, I actually run a writer's retreat in Prague. It's more of a residency with Charles University. And I'm looking for someone to attend and I'll pay for it.
What?
Right. So I'm thinking this guy's drunk after my kidneys or something else is going on. Like, so there was this camera somewhere and I'm being punked
Aren't there
because.
like millions of people who would give anything to be able to go to Prague for an open spot or something like this?
Right. But, you know, he had told Neil had told him about Tracy and he thought I was Tracy. But he loved having the conversation with me. And so he handed me the packet. I'm like, there's no way my husband's gonna let me do this. It's in the summer, even though we don't have a lot of farm stuff in the summer. There's just I've got little kids at home. And James just looked at me and said, you need to say yes, but think about it. So when I got home, I told my husband, I was like, I got into this. He wants me to go. And it's all paid for except for the plane ticket. And I already talked to your parents and they said they'd watch the kids and it's going to be great. And my husband was like, yeah, why don't you just buy yourself a new computer and a new camera lens too and like have at it, not understanding sarcasm. So I did. And, you know, I Googled the guy one more time to make sure he wasn't like a criminal, like a Jeffrey Epstein kind of guy, right? So I did all of that and I got a text message and it had this large attachment and it wasn't coming through. So I went down to the kitchen. It was from my husband. And he said, well, I printed off a copy just in case. I'm like, a copy of what? He said, divorce papers. It's me or poetry. And I was like, how about I go to Prague and then we come back and we go to counseling and we figure this thing out because that is a weird ultimatum. I don't understand it. Well, I came to understand it later. It was a weird ultimatum. While I was in Prague, he moved in with somebody he'd been seeing for 5 years. And, you know, very cliche midlife crisis.
Yeah.
So when I got back, he had told my children I was never coming home and just completely destroyed. Like he had moved the farm into an LLC that didn't have my name on it. He cashed out his pension and 401k a full year before that. Without my knowledge,
Wow.
and he'd been planning it for a while. That was just the lever he had decided to use to try and get me to look like the bad guy.
Yeah, so your life completely blew up.
Completely blew up. And so I went to Prague, and I was very sad, and it was very hard. And I wrote poetry, and I wrote my first book, and sent it off to be published, and it was accepted in 2016.
So you on that retreat, you wrote enough poems to make into a book?
I did.
Okay. Was
And
the
the poems
poetry
I've written
about
before.
this issue with your husband, or was it like a huge variety of subjects? Or
No, it was me trying to learn how to write a sonnet, but also I came up with this idea of myself as a Selkie trapped and landlocked in Iowa, because my family folklore has so many Selkies and skinwalkers. And I just wanted to incorporate that. So I started studying Irish mythology and Eastern European mythology and all of these female monsters who look like innocent women, but they're actually pretty powerful. And so I wrote it from the point of view of a Selkie trying to get herself back, to get her seal skin back when she's so far away from the ocean. And it's called Landlocked, the etymology of whale, fish, and grace. There's a lot of Moby Dick references in there too.
oh,
They're
wow.
fun. And because I had an argument with somebody, one of the opening epilogues to Moby Dick is the school teacher trying to explain the etymology of the word whale. And the scholar I was talking to said, no one will ever understand this. This is just like one of those cryptic mystery things. And I was like, I understand it. So I wrote a poem about how I understood it. And that became the anchor poem for the whole collection.
Meta. What
But
was
when I
the
got
process of getting published like for you?
Well, I'll get there because it was crazy.
Yeah.
So I get back from Prague. My life's blown up. I no longer have a home to live in. My kids and I were crashing on people's couches and living in the car for 6 months. I got into another program over Christmas at the Vermont Studios, but I couldn't leave until the divorce was finalized. I got full custody of my kids, permission to leave the state, but I had an online teaching job that was paying most of the bills, but it's not enough. I
Yeah.
had to get child support to make the difference. While I was at I didn't know what I was going to do. So over Christmas break, he had the kids. I went to Vermont. He calls me and said he took all of the money and bought a house for his new girlfriend. And it was a house I'd written about in my master's thesis.
Oh, this was like a famous house in your town that you loved.
It was the Alice Hubbard house. And we nicknamed it 1601 while I was writing my thesis. And so he just called and said, I bought 1601 for Caitlin, and I had a complete nervous breakdown in Vermont during the season of the sticks. There's a song about it now. So It was devastating, but I started binge watching Ashley Judd serial killer movies and fisting Vermont cheddar and meat sticks and searching realtor.com. And I'd always wanted to live in Savannah. And so I started like putting in search prompts, what house do I want? I called my aunt sobbing, like, I don't have money to buy a house. I don't know what I'm doing. And she said, I want to move to Savannah, completely unprompted. She said, I want to open a bed and breakfast in Savannah, find
Just the
something.
aunt who had had the farm in Colorado. What happened to all of your animals that you and your husband had?
Sold them. He just sold them at an auction, including my dog. He
No.
really, truly a villain.
He didn't care about the dog?
No. The dog we'd had for 18 years and was an elderly and Australian Shepherd and was my child before my children. And yeah, he insisted the dog needed to stay on the farm to keep the animals safe. And as soon as I agreed to that, they were gone, all of them.
I'm glad the Ashley Judd movies or what like brought you
Was
the
it?
montage in the movie when somebody hits rock bottom and then like whatever it is that brings them back. It was the cheese and this like particular triad of movies.
Yes. Yeah, it was. And I got on realtor.com and I found this house in Flemington, Georgia. And turns out I didn't need my aunt to help me buy it. She just co-signed it and I bought it. It was on foreclosure and didn't have electricity or plumbing. And it's like under a Tuscan sun, but with no money, three kids, and in rural Georgia. And I restored that house.
You have
And
this master's degree in what was
exactly.
it, materials of historical structures?
Yes. And I walked into what was then Armstrong and I said, I know you need adjuncts. And I still teach online and I want to work outside of the online world if you have an opening. And they did. And it was in Hinesville, which is right next to Flemington. So it was just like magical things
Yeah,
coming
it just
together.
all fell into place.
Yeah. And then I went to the director of Asaba and said, I will keep doing the internship for you, but I need I didn't need to say the S word, but I still did the intern stuff for you, but I need full tuition, not half. And he agreed to it. And then I pitched an idea to have a fall retreat too. So we did that. And things just kept getting really good. And I got the call that my book had been accepted for publication.
The landlocked.
Yeah, I actually got the call. So I had had an encounter with Ben Affleck at Lowe's that was really embarrassing. And I tried to go to his house to drop off an apology letter. And I was arguing with the security guards at the gate that it was could they just pass it on? And they were getting really agitated when I got the call from the publisher. And I'm like, never mind, I'm just gonna go on my way now. Thanks.
This is in Georgia, his house in Georgia.
Yeah, in Riceboro. And so I got the call and it was amazing. And it took another full year for the book to come out, but it was, and I had to pre-sell some of the copies to for them to determine how big of a press run they were going to do. So I did a lot of Facebook Live. I don't even know if that's still a thing, but a lot of Facebook Live pleas for people to buy my book ahead of time.
So this is
Really
just
got
on
out there.
you, like on you to kind of drum up the marketing and some buzz for it. What is the publishing house?
A small US publisher, but they're an Ingram imprint. So it's still Barnes and Noble, all of them, right? It's called Finishing Line Press out of Louisville, Kentucky. And a lot of folks criticized me for going with them, called it a vanity press because they shouldn't have to do the pre-sale thing. But they were really good to me and they brought me to New York City to read at the Poets House, which is amazing. And just other good things started happening up because of that book being published. And I took it on a book tour. And on the book tour, my ex called me yet again with news that he was getting married to the woman he'd been living with. And there was a whole bunch of drama, and my daughter didn't believe that they'd actually gotten married because the marriage ceremony didn't look right. And he sent me the wedding certificate, and they had gotten married just weeks after our divorce was finalized and had lied to the kids about it. And I don't know why that hit me so hard. I thought I was completely over everything, and but I was alone in a bed and breakfast in rural Michigan and no support, which is why he called me right then. He knew where I was at. And and I started crying again. My next stop was Toledo, Ohio, which was the best poetry reading I've ever done. 30 people showed up. Everybody bought two copies of the books. Toledo's amazing. Any poets out there listening, book your book tour to go, if it's poets, to go to Toledo, Ohio. They love poetry and they show it with their book buying.
Wow, what insider info. I love that.
It was the most fun on my book tour stop. Shwilicky, Pennsylvania was also really great, but nobody came to that one because the Penguins won the Stanley Cup and they were marching through the town with it. So I got to read my poetry and see the Stanley Cup.
I bet so the gentleman who had like recruited you to go to this Prague retreat, I bet he was so thrilled when you told
He
him
was.
you got a
He
book out of
was.
it.
Yeah, and he invited me back to Prague for another summer as well. So I did that the following year, and it was just as amazing. Except I knew my way around Prague.
That is very cool. Yeah, it's
And
been
I got more out of it that time. And
And
the
it's so
book,
beautiful and historical there. You must have loved that.
yes, the architecture and everything. I mean, some of the other students were taking weekend trips to other cities, and I'm like, there's so much here. I will never get through this whole city and learn everything I can about it. I went to the opera almost every weekend. I ended up sharing a booth with the Korean ambassador just because most American tourists don't dress up for the opera, but I did. I overdress for everything. It's just my thing. And so I had pearls on and high heels, and they said, you can sit here in this. And I ended up talking with the Korean ambassador for the whole of Don Giovanni. It was really incredible. And yeah, and I loved it. And James has been really great supporting my work. That the book I worked on there was a physics-based poetry book based on the relationship between Gödel and Einstein. And the anchoring piece in that collection is called the incompleteness theorem, which was a theorem that Gödel came up with, that time does not actually exist, which then nullified all of Einstein's equations. And Einstein sought him out, and they became very good friends and had a lot of really wonderful conversations in Prague. So
So did
I got,
Einstein ever reconcile this? Did Einstein
yeah,
reconcile?
no, yes and no. But my approach was the man who came up with this idea that time does not exist must have had his heart broken so deeply. And I wanted to explore his life more. And I ended up getting to have my poems reviewed by the granddaughter of one of his colleagues. So the physics got checked, and which gave me the idea for future poems. Every time I use physics theorems in poems, I find someone who's an expert in whatever it is and have them make sure it works, that the metaphors hold up, that I'm not getting the science wrong. And that has served me really well.
How did you come across this idea in the first place? Is Gödel is he a like a Czech with Prague?
Yeah, he lived in Prague, but okay, so it was weird because I was corresponding with Tony for Asaba stuff, and he was reading that there's a book about Gödel and Einstein's conversations, and I made a Beckett joke. I guess we're all just waiting for Gödel instead of waiting for Godot, and then that got me thinking, you know, Einstein was waiting for Gödel, and what was Gödel waiting for? And so I just started thinking about them on a park bench, having a conversation, a very Beckett-like conversation, and it just kind of manifested from there.
That is very cool that you were able to expand that out into an entire collection
Yeah,
of poetry.
it's not published though. I'm still like, those are a lot harder. I started working on another collection that, so I have three that aren't published that I'm like in stasis. And the larger one is a poetry book narrative based on real events that happened in Iowa to women, all domestic violence, all in rural southern Iowa, and kind of telling their stories in a fictionalized way through poems. And but it's about domestic violence, so of course my ex was like, "You're accusing me of things," and I said, "No, it's fictionalized. It's fictionalized. I am totally covered here. I didn't write about my own experiences at all, although there are my experiences in there. They are also the experiences of many other women. So it cannot be isolated like that." It's really hard to read those at readings. And then I wrote a secondary chat book expanding the idea of the consequences of on divorce on children, but told from Greek mythology.
Actually, I wanted to ask about this because on your website, you have a list of some of your published poetry, and you had one called Great Grandmother.
Yes.
It was about the first woman in Nebraska to try to file for divorce. And the poem was incredible. And in it, clearly this woman has been abused and nobody cares, and that's,
That it was actually my great grandmother. Although I cannot verify, this is just a family story that was passed down, and the family story never accused anybody in the family of. They all said it was an accident that she slipped, but it wasn't until I learned how to make soap, and the soap maker that was teaching me said, "You never move the lye. You never move the lye. Everything comes to the lye. You never, once the lye is on the stove, you never touch it."
because it's
And
so
it.
dangerous.
She had been making soap her whole life. There's no way she would have picked up the pot of lye and walked it across the room and slipped. There's just no way. And it reframed, she tried to file for divorce because he was abusive. And a week afterwards, this happens to her.
Right.
And she was permanently disfigured from here down. And my grandmother had to take over feeding all the farmhands. And she was 12 and had to leave school, take care of her siblings, and do all of that. Because my great grandmother was so injured and disabled. And it occurred to me that that story is often told in my family as a way to say, without saying, you don't get divorced. You don't even try. You don't even try.
That's
Bad
crazy
things
that that
happen.
is the lesson taken from it.
Yeah. I thought it was important to include in the collection, that it's generational. What we accept in one generation becomes the normal for the next and just accepted. I mean, it was acceptable for my grandmother's generation. It's okay if he hits you, if he loves you and he pays the bills. And then, it's not okay if he hits you, but the next generation, he can't hit you, but it's okay if he controls all your finances because you can't have a credit card anyway, right? You can't have a checking account. It wasn't legal yet for women to have those things in their name. It's okay if he has an affair as long as he provides for you and the kids, things that are acceptable. And then in my generation, we're starting to redefine all of the intricate ways that domestic violence can manifest that doesn't always include hitting.
There's some really insidious control aspects that aren't just the obvious. Yeah, so yeah, it's like each generation just gets very slowly, incrementally a little better, but
And now we have no fault divorce. My grandmother could have easily divorced and taken her farm property that was hers and raised the kids and been okay.
yeah, it's a
So
really powerful poem.
yeah, it was a European press that published it. I was very surprised I sent a bunch of them, and that's the one. They took two, and that was one of them.
Yeah,
I
cool.
actually have a book that a Big Five said, you need, there's nothing else like it. We can't publish it unless you're a chef, a pig farmer, or an internet influencer. And I'm like, I'm none of those things. It's a different book, and it's like the bane of my existence right now. It was about ethical pig farming, but
Wow.
not about how to do it and not how to cook things like a chef. It was, you're a consumer and you want to buy meat that's ethically raised. What questions do you ask? What are the answers? And so I wrote a book from my perspective as both a pig farmer and a consumer, because I'm not a pig farmer anymore and never will be a pig farmer again. It's brutal, horrible work. So they were like, well, if you were a pig farmer, you would have credibility as the author. And I'm like, yeah, I'm not a pig farmer. Can you go buy a farm and buy some pigs? And I'm like, no.
But you were. I mean, you do have that experience, which seems
Right.
very
I have that
rare.
experience.
So,
And they're like, well, do you have a culinary background? No, but I have several chefs that have endorsed it. Big ones like Michael Twitty and Adam, oh, I can't remember his name now, but he wrote this meat book. And they're like, yeah, we're gonna have to pass.
it seems, I mean, like in extremely rare to come across somebody who actually has experience as a pig farmer and now is now a professional writer and like wants to write a book from this point of view. So that seems wild that that
And
would
I had
get
a
announced.
celebrity endorsement. I had Craig Johnson, who wrote Longmire, but also Lou Diamond Phillips, who starred on the show. Like, they were all ready to endorse me. That wasn't enough.
Oh my gosh.
There's no book, there are no comps to this book.
I
There's
can't
no.
believe Lou Diamond Phillips can't pull some strings for you at like Random House.
Don't know how I feel about it, right? But it was really frustrating. And I told them, I think everybody would care about it. Everybody who eats, even like I specifically address vegans because I understand ethically not wanting to participate in the meat system. That's why I started raising ethically sourced meats. was because I didn't want to participate in eating either, and I wanted to do it a different way. And so, but I also tell funny stories about customers who came to my farm to see, because we call it the meet and greet.
The meet and greet, yeah.
So I wrote this whole book trying to be funny, tell my stories, and talk about what I'd seen in the industry, and then recipes.
Yeah, full circle.
Right. So, a third of the book was recipes, a third of it was how to properly store and freeze it, and explaining different cuts and all of that before. And then every recipe was simple. Like, you don't have to have a culinary degree to cook it.
Yeah. Well, I hope you
And
get this published someday. I mean, this seems really fascinating.
I keep looking for something else to come
Door
out like
opening,
it,
yeah.
that I could jump back in.
Are you so just not to change the subject too much, but I was curious a little bit just about your method of working. Do you have a routine? Do you get up every day and do it in a certain way, or that every day is different and wacky and you don't like a routine?
I love routine. I wish I had one. When I was really gung-ho about publishing all the time, it was Monday nights were for revision, and Tuesday nights were for sending things out, and Wednesday nights were for bookkeeping, and Thursday nights, Friday nights, and Saturday nights were for writing. And I would write before I would grade papers, and I had this whole like routine set up. And now I have four teenagers, and there is no routine. I am lucky if I can concentrate long enough to get a paragraph out on the memoir I'm working on. I do carry my camera everywhere with me, and do iPhones have come along so well. Now I can take raw photos with them. So, and my good camera was stolen on a trip to California. So I have a little Sony mirrorless now that is amazing. I never would have bought if my Nikon hadn't been stolen. So that slings with me a lot of times too.
Is
And
that a special like format of photos that it ends up with?
I don't, people like mirrorless. I don't understand exactly why mirrorless is so much better, but I can be on something that is shaking and take a clear picture. That's
Oh,
what I
okay.
care about. It's lightweight. I don't have to have like the big equipment. So I don't look like a serious photographer often because I
Yeah.
don't have the big equipment. It's just a little tiny camera. The guy at Bay Photo on Habersham, he was like, "Well, I have this Sony," and he didn't tell me it was a mirrorless. He just told me it was in my budget. And said he loved it and it would be good for action photography. So if I were out on the boats again, because not afraid of them anymore, that it would be really good. And it is. Like, I can hang upside down from a tree and get a perfect shot. I can.
Very cool. Are you so nowadays, what is your balance of your life like? Like you're teaching at Georgia Southern and then you're no, okay.
No, I'm up at University of South Carolina in Bluffton now, and it is amazing.
Okay.
An amazing writing community, amazing teaching. The students are great. My husband still works at Georgia Southern.
What subjects do you teach?
I teach just basic composition.
Okay.
But at University of South Carolina, I don't know if I want people to know this.
Oh,
They let me teach it with literature, any literature I want.
okay.
It's pretty amazing. So, this semester I'm teaching all poetry and short format lyrical essays. And the students were very suspicious of me at first, especially the basketball players. And but they've come around and we're having a good time.
Yeah, you've
And
seduced them with your writing choices.
I only bring in things I love and that I love to talk about, and I get them on board with it. And
So
it's
you're doing that, and then you're like chipping away on your memoir as well.
I am, and it's hard. Because it is like under a Tuscan sun, but with no money and three children, and in rural Georgia, there's two hurricanes and an old house, right? And a lot of it's funny. A lot of it's really funny, but a lot of it's really deeply emotional as well. Because I was rebuilding the house as I was rebuilding my sense of self,
Yeah.
and that's not an easy transformation. It's bloody and messy and.
Having this real big, heavy work to do all throughout the day kind of distracts you from having to really delve too far into your pain.
But at night when the kids would go to bed and I was just left with myself, or when they'd leave for the summer, I had to confront myself, because you don't just, when you leave a problem situation, some of the problems come with you. It's just, I think Stephanie Land, in an interview she did about her new book Class, she said, you move to a different place, but you still have you. And those problems don't necessarily go away. So
Yeah.
I had to really confront confront myself in my role in everything that had happened, and what I was going to do better, including future plans. Like if I was going to date again, what that would look like for my kids. And it was hard because in this era of online apps, I was on them for like 10 minutes and so horrified that I threw my phone and broke it to get a new phone. And then all of a sudden, one of my coworkers, and it was Tony, we ran a retreat together. He asked me out to dinner, and I was like, babysitters are expensive, and I got three kids. And he was very patient. And so we started with lunches. And he had gone through a pretty terrible divorce too, but had come out on the other side of it. He lived across the alleyway from his ex, and they raised their kid together, and they were good friends. And I was like, that's really telling about someone's character, that they can still get along with someone after a terrible divorce, because
Yeah. Well,
I can't.
especially with how your husband ended up being, that must have been like an incredible thing to learn about him.
And 2.5 years later, and three proposals, I finally said yes.
How long have you been married now?
Since 2020. Is
Okay.
that the year COVID hit?
Yes.
Yeah, he proposed right before COVID.
Okay.
And we hosted one of the writers' retreats, and COVID hit. We didn't have internet or radio out there, so we didn't know.
Oh,
We
wow.
come back, and all of the grocery stores are stripped of toilet paper and green beans and cereal. And people weren't wearing masks yet, but school was canceled. It was like stepping into an apocalyptic parallel world. It
Yeah, that's
was
crazy
bizarre.
timing. Yeah.
And we didn't have the kind of adjustment or initial panic that everybody else did. So it was very surreal.
Yeah. I know that you just came back from, you were like living at the Asaba Spring Retreat and you were one of the faculty members. Does he do it at the same time as you, or you will both be there?
Yeah, we'll both be there.
Okay.
Yeah, the hardest part about that is finding a babysitter for our
Yeah, I
teenagers.
was gonna say, I'm excited to talk about the retreat.
Yeah,
Yeah.
we just did it, and I'm still tired.
I bet.
It was I think the biggest one we'd ever done. Although my husband argues with me. He said there's 2015 was bigger, but we had less faculty, so I think it was the same. There was a lot of drama that year, and that's what I remember more.
That's interesting. Like amongst the faculty or amongst the students or okay.
This year there was none. It was like, knock on wood, it was so lovely. We didn't have any personality crashes. We didn't have our clashes. We didn't have faculty fighting with each other. Everyone got along great.
Yeah. It occurs to me just as you're talking that a retreat where people are going and staying for periods of time, it's a little bit like a reality show where it's just random people thrown together.
Yes, and you can't leave. Like, you can't even take a walk to a gas station, right? Like, there's
Yeah, it's like a Love Island type of show, but then you're also trying to produce something creatively. That's kind of wild.
And also writers are not the least dramatic people on this planet.
Exactly. All these retreats, they're for artists or writers, so they're just wacky people in general.
Yes.
Big personalities.
Really big personalities. And some of those personalities sometimes like clash with each other to see who's top dog or
Oh.
get the attention of the faculty the most. What I find is smaller groups like this, there's a little less of that because there's so much attention to be had by everyone that it's not competitive like that. Like at Swanee, that's a conference with like 300 writers,
Yeah.
right? So there's a lot of backstabbing and shenanigans to get the attention of really important people who will get you published. Here, it's not, nobody, I won't say that our faculty, they don't have the power to get you published, but they also won't do that.
Is
They
it
will guide
more just
you and network you and help you get your work ready. But we don't usually have people who are at the top come to our retreats. We have beginners, people outside of academia. Every now and then, someone in academia who's not really making the connections that they wanted to,
Yeah.
for various reasons. Like when I went to grad school both times, I had children, I had small babies, or I was a single mom, and I just didn't have time to go out to the bars afterwards and talk about whoever they were talking about literarily wise. So I never really got the salon aspect of it or the friendship aspect of
Right,
it.
and the networking is such a huge part of all that.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah.
And so this instead kind of provides that network of for people who go to the retreat afterwards, they stay in touch with each other. We create little cohorts to make that easy. But
Yeah.
this year, I was so overwhelmed with the kitchen duties that I didn't get around to doing it, and they did it themselves.
This has been really, I mean, this is fascinating. Your stories are like incredible. I could listen to this all day, but we're kind of coming final things you want to say just about Savannah in general or goals that you have for your art or writing.
I do. So I do eventually, so three poetry books and a book about pigs. I do hope to find them homes to eventually get them out and done and into the world, and drop some of my perfectionism about it. My first book I submitted with the confidence of a 4-year-old in a Batman cape. I didn't really like, nothing held me back. I had no self-doubts, but now it's, I'm struggling with that. And I've talked to a lot of other writers and they've said they struggle with it too. Quite a bit, especially at this point in their career. But Savannah, the community in Savannah, especially the book lady at the Book Lady Bookstore, sometimes when I feel sad, I just stop by there and she always has my book facing forward in
Oh.
the both in poetry and the local writers. And I love that. It always makes me feel like really important. And one time I walked in and she was actually pitching my book to someone who was standing in front of the poetry. She didn't know I was going to show up. I just love her enthusiasm and support for local writers. And it's, she does more than she realizes, I think, in supporting us in the way that she does so enthusiastically. And she's the one who encouraged me to start my memoir. She said, poets make the best memoirs.
Yeah.
And I was like,
Why
okay,
is that? Okay.
because of the lyrical writing and ability to metaphor. And so I started studying poets who'd written memoirs like Patricia Lockwood, and she's right. There's a different quality to the writing when it's lyrical. But yeah, so I love all of it. I just feel like I've come home to a community that just without question, welcomed me as an outsider. And it turns out lots of them are outsiders too. So
Yeah.
many of the writers here aren't from here, and it doesn't seem to matter too much. We've all come to love this place as home. I would be in Savannah, except Richmond Hill has really, really good schools, especially the band. And I have a trumpet player. So
Yeah.
yeah, she definitely has benefited from being here. Richmond Hill's great too. The art community down here and Arts on the Coast is fantastic. And they're the ones that have really pushed me to do the fine art photography more.
Yeah, I know I have a few. There's Joy Flynn lives out there and Paul Down and Heather Young.
Yes.
Live there
Heather's
too.
my neighbor.
Oh, that's so funny. What a small world.
Yes. Yeah. She lives across on Kingston and has a similar studio space to mine.
Well, I definitely have to interview her soon because the other two that I just mentioned, I have interviewed as well. So I'm trying to get through all of you Richmond Hillers. I love it.
And Arts on the Coast has just been so fantastic because I don't know how to really navigate the gallery world, and
Yeah.
they've been really helpful and non-judgmental and like, here's how you do it. Or I'd bring a piece in and be like, yep, nope. What about that other one we saw you post? Go home and bring that one in. And it's so like I could get mad about that, but instead it's just like they're trying to help me be the best I
Yeah.
can. So encouraging and warm. I think Henry Ford would be really proud.
Well, so for locals who are interested in your book, so it sounds like they can go to the book lady and get it. If people
Yeah, they
aren't
can.
local, can they like order it off your website?
They can order it on Amazon
Okay.
or Barnes and Noble or anywhere you get books.
I will post with the show links. I will post links to your Ospa retreat and I'll post your link as well and your Instagram. And well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate this. It's been fascinating to hear
Yeah.
about from the farming to frog. And back.
I can talk. I can tell stories that I told you. I'm good at being interviewed on podcasts. If only that skill would get my book sold.
Real Southern tradition, so that's perfect. Okay, well,
Yeah.
this has been Arts on the Air with Tamara Garvey, and we've been with Danelle Lejeune. Thank you so much.
Thank you.